This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
So are that many people really taking up for Eli?
There are people.
There are people that get really indignant about it, I know, but I just assumed they were all Giants fans that would say that, oh, he definitely is. There's no question about it. I think sometimes people mistake their own emotional attachment for actual genuine greatness.
Maybe.
You can be emotionally attached to many things that doesn't necessarily make them great.
Yeah.
You know, you're emotionally attached to people in your family. That doesn't mean they're actually good accountants. They're the accountant. Okay, you've got an accountant. Maybe you're married to an accountant.
Right.
And she is the accountant that you love most. That doesn't make her the best accountant.
It's true.
Just because you love her doesn't make her a great accountant.
I don't think anybody's ready to fight us in the parking lot over it, but there are people claiming he's a Hall of Famer on there.
Yeah,
and
I don't know.
I honestly,
this is what I would say. Keep bringing your arguments to me because I've seen them all and not a single one does it for me. I have yet to see a compelling argument other than like, well, Terry Bradshaw doesn't belong in there. Okay, now wait a second. So you're saying that somebody not belonging in the Hall of Fame is an argument for putting somebody else who doesn't belong in the Hall of Fame? Doesn't make any damn sense at all.
May I point something out as well? We're losing sight of one thing with the Terry Bradshaw argument. He won four Super Bowls.
Four.
Not two.
Yeah,
he
four.
Won four. It's not the same.
Oh, no, the worst, though, too. Because there's some people that have legitimate arguments for Eli Manning, but then there are others that will bring up the stats of guys that played in 1960.
Right.
You know, like when it was just a completely different
league.
Totally
different game.
You weren't allowed to. You know what receivers didn't do in 1960? They wouldn't go anywhere like near the hash marks.
Right.
Terrified. Because they could literally have their head taken off.
That's right.
By hacksaw or a clothesline, anything like that.
Yep.
You were literally allowed to bring a chainsaw out onto the field and saw off the head of a slot receiver if he tried to go.
If you go, there are some. Go to YouTube, kids. There's the defensive backs sawing off people's appendages.
I don't know if slot receivers existed before the run and shoot in the NFL.
I don't know that they did either. I'm not sure.
Three wide receivers? Are you crazy?
This guy's nuts. This guy's bonkos. So we heard Mike D'Antoni talking about Russ crashing the glass last night. Russ himself said that was important.
It fuels our team, I think, and it fuels our break. It gets us out. It's tough to stop, man. You get a rebound and it push you right away. It's kind of something you can't scout for, and I think it's an advantage of ours that we got to take advantage of.
I will say this, Seth, about the Russ-James dynamic. I think that Chris Paul was a better fit alongside James. Now, maybe it ends up – maybe Russ and James continue to get more and more comfortable with each other. I just feel like all the concerns people had about Chris Paul when he first got here, about the quote-unquote ball-dominant nature of Chris Paul, which those concerns were, I think, almost immediately pushed aside because we could see they worked well enough together to win 65 games and nearly get to the NBA Finals through Golden State. I thought they ultimately fit really well together basketball-wise. We know personality-wise, ultimately, it didn't work out. It's still a work in progress with Russ. Russ is a guy who needs the ball in his hands, I think, more than Chris Paul did, in part because Russ is not a great outside shooter. He doesn't shoot threes anymore, which is fine. But one area of the game that I think Russ, that I was excited about when they traded for him, and that he affected last night for sure, Russ is, he is a beast on the glass.
Mm-hmm.
Effort-wise, athleticism-wise. I know some of the rebounds when he was doing the whole triple-double thing for a couple years were a little fugazi.
Those were just
guys boxing
easy,
everybody out and letting him get rebounds.
Yeah.
You watch Russell Westbrook enough, he's a good rebounder for a guard. And this was a team that needed rebounding help as well in the offseason.
And I guess there are a couple things about last night. For one, instantly you could point out very validly that the Nuggets didn't have either of their starting guards. You know, Millsap was out. Plumlee was out. Jokic ends up playing a whole bunch of minutes. Jokic looked like he was going to have a heart attack out on the floor.
He did.
He just looked like exhausted. But I'm okay with that. This game last night
You're okay with Jokic having a heart attack on the floor?
Not entirely. Okay. And I would say that I think that the thing about last night, it felt a little bit like, hey, What do you do when you're in a shooting slump? You go shoot some layups, you know, get right. the easy bat. I felt like last night's game was a little bit of a layup. And yes, you're facing a depleted Nuggets squad in which Jokic was almost having some kind of a medical event out on the floor.
Right.
He really did. I was honestly actually starting to worry about him.
No, he looked.
He was running the way like 9-year-olds in gym class do when you can feel like they don't, you, they haven't even learned how to like run when they're tired yet and their arms are flailing
yes,
out and everything.
There, yeah. Where there's nothing smooth about
yeah.
it. There's this, the human condition when it comes to running is that the more tired you are, the more you're moving every body part to try to get your body. And that's a large body he's trying to move.
Yeah,
right?
But even professional athletes usually get to the point where they know not to do that. Like they at least try to conserve energy
you're right,
when they're
he
tired.
Did. He looked like he was in junior high.
He looked like a kid that didn't know how to be tired.
Didn't know how to run.
Which, how did he know how to credit Capella? You try to run up and down the court with Capella in extended minutes, you're going to be here. And he was playing with Jokic was playing with the backups at points.
He was, yeah.
But then the other thing, too, I think, is Eric Gordon. Look, we know that Eric Gordon is a hugely and vitally important part of this team, especially if it's on an off night for James Harden or Russell Westbrook. Gordon hasn't quite been himself. Like he hit a bunch of threes last night. He started looking a lot more like himself. So I felt good about last night.
6 of 8 from three, 8 of 11 overall. Mike D'Antoni says that we're going to be just fine.
If we can get everybody together like tonight, you know, James has a good game, Eric has a good game, Russell has. If we get those three having a good game, we're going to be a tough. Yeah, we're good. And we just have struggled with that. And when James was playing really well, Russ wasn't playing well, and Eric was out. And now James not playing really well, Russ is. But tonight, all three of them kind of got in there together. So you can see that we can be potentially devastating. But, you know, potential means up to now we haven't done anything.
Yeah.
That's the definition of potential.
That's Mike D'Antoni talking about the Rockets. Text message, do you not remember how awful Paul and Harden were? I really think the dialogue that's going around is faulty. Russ and Harden are complimentary. Not always.
Awful.
Not always
Paul and
on,
Harden
but
are.
Not always on, fine. But Russ destroys and Harden rains fire. Okay.
Paul and Harden were awful? What the hell are you
talking
about?
They won 65 games.
They were one of the best offenses
games.
In the league. Yeah. Right. All right. Okay.
They were one of the most efficient offenses in the league,
this
and
damn,
they won 65
dude,
games.
Honestly, the Warriors just convoluted everybody's notion of what good basketball
right.
was anymore. I mean, I guess there are people that genuinely felt like the Rockets weren't a good basketball team because they couldn't beat the Warriors. I honestly don't know what to do with that. What the hell?
This
what
person
the hell do you
says
they're awful.
This I'm reading this sentence. Do you not remember how awful Paul and Harden were? My answer: no.
Yeah,
I don't remember
how awful.
Enlighten
they were.
Me, 3014.
Please, explain to me exactly just how awful.
Tell
they
me
were.
How awful they were when they won 65 games and they got to the Western Conference Final, or they came within a pulled hamstring of getting the NBA Finals. No, I actually don't remember that. So we had a good time. That was fun at the game last night.
It was a really good time.
Celebrate my birthday with you guys.
It was
cool.
Yeah, and Clint was there. That's actually the first time I've been able to sit down and just hang out with Clint for a while. You know, somebody on social media pointed out that in the picture that we put out that you were sitting next to Clint and not me, and that I was off on the end and that I should be upset about
that. It wasn't that way the whole game.
Well, I just wanted to know that I didn't notice it until I saw the photo.
Oh, okay.
And for that one quarter where I had to sit down at the end, I think I'm going to pull my best junior high cafeteria adolescent girl thing here.
Are we going to feign some beef?
I'm going to get upset about that, yeah. I'm going to start plotting against you now.
Were people noting that because you and I weren't sitting next to each other, so we may be co-hosts that aren't getting along or something
yeah,
like that?
Yeah, I think that might be what it was.
Just
yeah.
to be clear, we did sit next to each other in the first half,
yeah.
but then we were down in the Lexus Lounge at halftime,
yeah.
and then a bunch of us went back out in the middle of the third quarter, but you stayed down there because you were chatting with your former teammate.
I was talking to Andre
Johnson.
And
yeah.
he was having a good time. And I met some of his friends that I'd never met before, too, which is,
were they nice?
Which is really cool. Yeah, yeah. You know what's interesting? I told Andre last night, and it's one of these weird things when you've known somebody for so long that you don't really think to say it. Like, Andre, for me, that was my introduction to, like, being a genuine NFL fan, which was after I was done playing. Andre really came into his own when Kubiak got here.
Yes.
You know, Andre had been awesome before that, but it wasn't nearly the same level of production. So, like, to be able to watch Andre do what he became in Kubiak's offense and everything, and Andre was the first. I used to be kind of old school NFL and felt like, rookies should have to earn being starters and everything, and You shouldn't just hand it to him on the first day of training camp. All that changed when I saw Andre Johnson as a rookie. I was like, oh, okay, I get it now.
How many seconds did it take for that opinion to change?
The first day I was like, I can't believe they're starting him right away. I don't know if it's like maybe the third period of practice. I'm like, oh, yeah.
Now I see.
Human beings aren't typically capable of doing such things. And remember, I'd watch Jimmy Smith and Keenan McCardle in practice every day too. So I had a high standard for what I expected to see. Yeah, obviously. You know, Jimmy was just so fast. And Andre had a slightly different skill set than Jimmy Smith, but both those were old school X receiver types, like big, fast dudes that could win on the outside. Yeah. So I'd just come off of watching Jimmy Smith in practice every year for 5 years, and I go out and I'm on the practice field and I see Andre Johnson. I'm like, oh, okay, I guess this is just what NFL teams have. I guess we just have a big freak physical specimen that can win any track meet with any guy on the field.
Yeah, he is all that. That's for sure. So was it nice catching up with him?
It was. Yeah, it was. And he's just such an under. There's just no BS about him.
No, I like
I'm glad he's around the team.
I am too.
Although I would say Wallace, who got us the tickets, and his wife Dee Dee, his one employee Dave. Dave's a University of Miami guy.
He is.
When I came back out in the fourth quarter, Dave was like, Seth, next time you talk to Andre, tell him he's got to go back and coach at the U.
Oh.
Yeah.
I bet they would like that.
I guess so.
I don't think Andre would like it necessarily.
Is he going to move back to Miami? Can you
imagine Andre having to go on the road and recruit high school kids? I don't think Andre would suffer for having to deal with 18-year-olds like trying to convince them to go to the U.
I bet every single one of those guys that played back in the heyday, though, has got fantasies of like, man, we got to turn it around at some point. I'd like to be a part of that.
For sure. And then they realize that it's a grind to be a coach. Like, Clyde Drexler thought that with U of H basketball back in the day. And he became the head coach. And he realized, like, probably early on in his first season, like, wow, this is a lot of work to coach a college basketball team.
What's the cushiest coaching job? I feel like every single one of them, I think coaching is just coaching, and you become obsessed with it no matter what.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a – now, I know that football kind of has its certain demands because there are just so many numbers involved. I think it lends itself to – I think football coaches spend more time breaking down film at 2 in the morning and then getting up at 4 in the morning because they just get completely consumed with it. And there's always something, there's always a stone that you want to unturn.
Yes.
Where with basketball, it's not quite as much so. I feel like basketball, it travels harder, but they don't necessarily beat themselves up as much with it.
The cushiest coaching job. Now, I'm not saying just head coaching or manager, just cushiest coaching job that probably pays really, really well.
Yeah.
First base coach in baseball.
Oh, okay. Well, I think
I'm including assistants, and that's theoretically.
I think baseball is probably the job. And again, to be a good coach at any level, it's really, really hard.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not diminishing that whatsoever, but I feel like being a position coach in baseball might be the easiest place to skate by.
Like, when you say position coach, you mean like a first base or a third base coach?
Right.
Kind of thing?
But those guys are usually also like the outfield coach. Pettis works with the outfielders,
does
I believe.
He? Okay, yeah. Okay, maybe I didn't know that because they don't have that title.
Your in-game responsibility, but it's not like you can be out there. You can't be out there in center field telling Mariznick what to do.
That's
so
true, yeah,
you go and you man third base. Yeah.
So anything outside of being a manager in baseball.
But as a position coach in baseball, but even these days, then now you're sitting down and working with the high speed film people
know,
and everything and trying to break it all down.
Pouring through numbers.
But still, that's to be good. To just skate by, I think baseball might make the most sense.
Just skate
by. I feel like baseball, you get the most mileage out of being a good storyteller.
Yeah.
Like people just, you need guys that are around. Guys that are around to like lighten the mood.
Seth, that's what I was doing at that charity event you were talking about when we were rebuilding that house. That's who I was.
But honestly, really,
the storyteller.
You're helping people enjoy their jobs
that's
better, which in baseball is that you got 162 damn games. You're traveling all the time.
I should apply for that. I should be the first base coach for the Astros.
You're going to be out there.
That'd be awesome.
You're gonna be
dig,
out there
dig, dig. And then I'm just telling stories the rest of the time.
No, the cushiest job in baseball
is
coaching. It's not cushy. It'd be physically demanding, but I feel like bullpen catcher, Javier Bracamonte.
That's the Astros bullpen coach, huh?
Yeah, I feel like that would be now that's physically demanding, of course. But
you gotta squat
But you're kind of almost it's almost like being it's almost like getting to still be a player, you know? Like
I think the biggest stress point for coaches, and if you're jumping in with us here and you're wondering what we're talking about, we got on a tangent of in the previous segment of what would be the cushiest coaching job out there. Because we were talking about Andre Johnson and people saying he should go back and coach at the U and rescue the U and so forth, and without people realizing that going and coaching anything in college involves recruiting. Mm-hmm. First of all, let's be clear. None of the college jobs are easy jobs because you have to recruit. Recruiting would suck. Getting on a plane and trying to convince teenagers to come play for you would be just a pride smothering siege. So let's start with that. So it would be something professional. To me, what makes for the cushiest coaching jobs is when you have no responsibility for any decision making that can impact winning or losing. That's why I said first base coach, not third base coach, because third base coach I would think would be kind of stressful. You know what I mean?
Third base coach, especially when you're as
in the postseason and you're
when your responsibility is to execute your organization's plan, which is, hey, chances of a bad throw at home plate are pretty good, so send them no matter what, then you draw a lot of ire.
Yeah.
Oh, remember, people that were not on board with that until the Astros got good.
Right.
There was some diciness there while the Astros were sending people to home, and every time they got thrown out, like, oh, Pettis is a moron, I can't believe it. Now he's a hero.
It got easier when most of his job just became dapping guys up as they were hitting home runs rounding third.
I can't even remember when Mrazek had the collision at home plate this year.
Yeah.
What were we saying about the decision to send him third base? I can't remember if he went rogue on that or
someone
not.
Someone will text us. Yeah. 713-572-4610. So Jerry Jones was in town the other day for the Houston Sports Awards. We had an opportunity, Clint Sterner and I did, to sit down with him. Really enjoyed that conversation. Some of the media outlets have picked up various parts of that conversation that we had with him, which tells me that anytime Jerry Jones speaks, people are listening. One of the things that they picked up was Jerry Jones answering a question I asked of him about the rivalry between Houston and Dallas. And with the schedule possibly increasing with the next CBA to 17 games, or maybe with the league possibly down the road looking at changing the way they do the schedule, would he like to see an annual rivalry, an annual game between the Cowboys and the Texans?
I've always thought that these natural rivalries should be accentuated relative to the NFL, where they've got them, and they do have some of them. They've been engendered by the fact that they're in the same division a lot of times. But there are some others that aren't, and those make great games and make great natural, my town against your town, my city against your city. Nobody's got any more of that than Dallas and Houston, so I like the idea.
Do you think Cowboy fans agree with that last part, Seth, that nobody's got more than that? I think Houston would agree. I think the Texans and the fans here would love to play the Cowboys every year. I just, the Cowboys.
You said nobody has more what?
He said nobody, he basically paraphrasing, nobody's got a bigger rivalry than between Dallas and Houston.
Yeah, rivalry between Dallas and Houston. I feel like it's a rivalry that I feel like local news outlets and radio station program directors really want there to be more of a rivalry than there actually is.
Yeah.
I don't know if I think a lot of it, and sometimes this is what I underestimate. I underestimate what people have to deal with at their workplaces, where like if you're working in a warehouse or you're working in an office, that when the Cowboys are doing well, how annoying it can be to have to talk to them about it. But I don't know if it would be a natural rivalry if they faced each other more often. Now, it's become more so since the Astros are in the same league as the Rangers now.
Rivalry between the two cities.
Yeah, rivalry between the two cities.
Yes, but I agree with
the
that.
The Astros and the Rangers being in the same league has made a big difference because now you face them regularly. And then obviously you have the Mavericks dynamic too.
Yep.
So it's a natural rivalry. I don't know if I think there's other cities that have bigger ones.
Yeah. Well, and it just specific to the Cowboys.
Yeah.
And that's really where the question I'm posing is Jerry talking about how fierce the rivalry is between Houston and Dallas. If we just take it to the football teams and the fan bases, I think Texan fans would love to play the Cowboys every year. I think my sense is with Cowboy fans, and I realize I'm putting words in their mouth, I'm just guessing, is that it'd be cool to play the Texans every year, but it would take a lot for the Texans rivalry to reach the level for the Cowboys of any of the three teams that they're in their division with right now. Maybe teams like Green Bay, maybe even a team like Pittsburgh in the AFC, who they faced off in the Super Bowl with a few times. I feel like if you were to ask Cowboy fans, just I'll put it real simply and then get your thoughts on it. If you ask the average Cowboy fan to list in order their biggest rivals, I don't know that you get down. where do the Texans show up? Like ninth on that list, maybe?
I don't know. The interesting thing about Dallas is that they seem to be consumed with explaining, like unprovoked, they need to be sure that we know that they don't think about us that much.
Yes.
There gets very much a feel of like a woman who's going to show her ex-boyfriend just how much she's over him by going out with some guy and like trying to flaunt it in front of him. And meanwhile, the ex-boyfriend's like, all right, cool, whatever. And she's saying, you see, you can't have this.
Right.
And the guy's like, all right. Like, I feel like we in Houston are kind of like, all right, I guess I don't get to have your high STD rate and your teased up hair like it's still 1989 and wearing weird, gaudy
right.
jewelry and everything.
Thank
all
you.
Right, sorry,
thank you very much.
I understand. Yeah. I guess, I can't afford right. turquoise.
Same
all right,
thing.
Great, whatever.
Yep.
So I think they are perhaps more, they're more consumed with Houston than they want to admit. They have some weird haughtiness about it where they have to act like they don't care.
Do you think there's any element to a potential Cowboys-Texans game? And look, we know this is not happening anytime soon, but it is fun to think about. Where if they added a 17th game to the schedule, and that became for some of the teams, that became the rivalry game.
Yeah.
I realize it's hard to have a rivalry for all 32 teams. Like, who is Arizona's rival, right? Like, mm-hmm. you know, but it's easy to do in LA with two teams there. It's easy to do in Texas with two teams here. It's easy to do with Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, and Pittsburgh. It's easy to do, I think, in some area. Maybe you could get half the teams in the league, you could get involved in some sort of rivalry game, and it would stand up.
Over time, it gets stronger. Yeah,
yeah, and that's where I'm going with this, Seth. If there were a Texans and Cowboys game each year, is there a potential for that game to become kind of what it's like in college with these games where, hey, we had an okay year, it didn't live up to expectations, but damn, we beat the Cowboys again. We've beaten them four straight years.
Right.
Is there any potential for that in the NFL like there is in college, do you think?
I think it would be a really, really good idea. I just don't see anybody ever changing the structure of the way things work right now.
And it's very clean.
No, but it is interesting because the NFL does with its scheduling. It's all set up to try to kind of normalize it because you have to – every year people think that somehow the Patriots are getting an easier schedule and it's conspiracy or something. It's all set in stone.
Formulaic.
The way it's going to work, there's a formula and it's all based on which divisions you're playing yeah. that year and which win-loss record you're playing. But it's not actually set up to equalize things as much as you might think.
Right.
And it's even less so now that teams fluctuate so much from year to year.
Yeah.
So I think the argument that you have to try to maintain competitive balance, I don't think that holds as much water as it used to.
Yeah.
So like there will be some, but think about this though. Like what if you're the team that gets to face the Bills for these last 20 years? Like you have an extra game against the Bills for the last 20 years. Well, you can, you know, you could argue that has been the New England Patriots.
Yeah,
they already have
it. That's what people argue. Like they have such an easy schedule. Yeah, it's because they play in a crap division.
Yeah,
they play six games against the dregs every year.
It's one of those things like you try so hard to prevent something from happening that's already happening.
Yeah.
So well, you know, you can't have that yearly rivalry because then the schedules won't be fair. Well, the schedules they're not fair to begin with.
Yeah. This is what I would do. If they went to a 17th game, if they added a 17th game, I would just leave the rest of the schedule at the 16 games that already exist. I would leave that formula as is. For the 17th game, I would take the teams that are able to have a natural rival. Let's pretend that 18 of the teams have a natural rival.
Okay,
you can schedule a natural rival for about half the league. I would schedule that rivalry every year, and then the other 16 or 14 teams that are left over, just randomly cycle. It's, you know, this year we're playing this team, this year we're yeah. playing that team. Don't try to create artificial rivalries.
Does it matter, but does it change the fact that you'd be facing inter-conference foe?
No, it'd have to be between conferences. So in other words,
it'd have to be AFC versus NFC?
Yes, because okay. you're already, you know, theoretically, you're probably in the division
true.
With them playing them twice
okay.
already. Yeah.
So, but then there might be, so there would be every 4 years you'd play the Cowboys twice.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, that's the way it would work out
maybe.
If it was the 17th game.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, obviously, I haven't thought this all
I'm
the way through.
I'm for it. As one of our listeners points out, that the Cowboys already have three really super strong rivalries because it's the NFC East. The NFC East is simply, like, whether you love them or hate them,
yeah.
for that reason, that's why it's one of the best conferences
in football.
It would
take the Texans 10 years to crack the level of those rivalries.
Those rivalries are just so intense and long-standing, yep. and each team has had their championship moments and eras.
And you're some playing
more than
for something.
Some more than others. Sorry, Jonesy. Yeah. But, you know, those other three teams have had really, really great, outstanding histories of winning championships, unlike the Eagles.
Jonesy, remind him who the most recent NFC East team is to win a championship.
How many total do you have?
Well, we have the NFL championship in 1960 as well.
Oh, okay. No, I'm talking about Super Bowl championship.
Seth,
we
have argument.
One. You have one, right? Yeah.
Yeah. We're talking in the era of color television.
The Redskins have had a dynasty. You know, the Giants have won four. What's that? Yeah. So it's
Cowboys have had multiple dynasties.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A long time ago.
Yeah.
Not this century.
No. Yeah. Not this century.
Yeah.
But Jerry Jones promises that it's coming soon.
Does it surprise any Cowboys fans at all that Romo had a blistering start as an awesome commentator, but then this year kind of lost his passion?
Probably not.
Does it surprise anybody that Romo in the playoffs this year especially was just not that good?
It's a metaphor for something.
Romo has great promise, but this year in the playoffs he was an extreme disappointment.
Sean Pendergast and Seth Payne with you on a Thursday. Final segment of the show. It's a final segment on a Thursday. It means that it's time to talk to Darren Revelle, the Action Network, who is sponsored by the Action Network. If you are looking for an edge, you can download the free Action Network app and get live odds and expert analysis for every game, a chance to talk a little sports business and a little sports wagering with our friend Darren Revelle. Darren, great to have you on, as always. I have not had a chance to check in on the payoff on the Fade Revelle yet. Where if you lost your bet last week, you would have to get hit by an NFL running back. Did that take place?
It did take place.
And you're alive.
It was in Nashville, Tennessee, and it was Eddie George.
Oh, wow.
And
he looks like he keeps himself in shape.
Yeah, he keeps himself in shape. He's also like 6'5" and a half, I've kept in touch with him. He's had a remarkable career from, you know, he went to Kellogg Northwestern Business School and was on Broadway. I actually saw him on Broadway in Chicago. He still has like an acting career going. He's like a real renaissance man. He's kind of done everything. And now he's doing financial planning and stuff. And so we invited him out and, you know, obviously I know what he looks like, but like just then realizing that like he's there to hit you. So he did tell me on the phone early on that it was hard because I can't tackle him because he'd run around me.
Right.
So we had to figure out like, okay, what's going to happen here? And I, you know, originally when we were on the phone, we were talking about, well, you're going to run into me. And he made it very clear that I would get very hurt if he just, you know, just ran into me. Pads or no pads. If I had pads, he didn't. It didn't matter.
Right, so, that would be ethically like a boxer agreeing to fight an amateur or something.
He ethically can't
do it, yeah.
So we had to do something where he could go full force and I could be protected in some way but would still get my butt kicked. And so the final thing was we got one of those big blow-up balls that you can put yourself in. And he ran at full speed, and I was inside the ball, and he pretty much just, you know, knocked me over, and I was upside down. You'll see, go watch it. It's a pretty nice treat, and yeah. Eddie was great.
Did you, Seth, Darren? As you probably know, my co-host here played 10 years along the defensive line in the NFL, including in the same division with Eddie George for a number of years. I'm assuming you tackled Eddie George several times.
But I was wearing pads.
No, I know, but can you describe what that's like? Is it fun to tackle Eddie George or is it not?
Well, it's fun when you successfully tackle.
Right.
But you bounce off of him a lot of the times, too. Yeah. And I would imagine like that getting hit when you're wearing that and when you're ensconced in that rubber ball, you can still jostle your brain around a little bit, man. I'm concerned.
A lot of people are like, oh, that's not enough. And I was like, the second time he hit me, I had to have my face above to see him coming and then tuck. I mean, I practiced inside this ball like for an hour. Okay. because I then had to tuck my head in because I didn't want to get my head hurt. But the way I tucked my head in, the way he hit me on the side, I thought I broke my nose. It was not completely risk free. And then I'm like upside down. But the most amazing thing about Eddie, and we talked about this, he did say Ray Lewis was his hardest defender to go up against. But the thing that we talked about was the pads from 1994 to, you know, essentially maybe 98, 99, where these running backs in college and the pros, really in college, like Eddie, like running backs and linebackers, like Andy Katzenmoyer was like a building.
Yeah.
I mean, like the, you know, it's, and what these guys were wearing. And it's just amazing to me how some of these running backs could even turn the corner. I mean, run up the middle like Ron Dane, fine. But like, I mean, the amount of pads these guys had on was ridiculous.
That's it, you know, and I actually had that discussion with somebody last night about just how these are guys that grew up, you know, with Oklahoma football. That you wonder when Curtis Martin used to be wearing basically a suit of armor, and he lasted forever in the NFL. And you wonder how much of a lot of the injury issues these days would be as simple as, hey, let's go to the old school huge pads, because there just wasn't as much skin and bone exposed back then.
I remember when the first time I stood next, because Peyton was clearly using what he played in at Tennessee for his pads. And I remember in the Super Bowl, what was it? It was Colts Bears.
Yep.
And I remember the difference between standing after the game, standing next to Peyton and what was it, Rex Grossman? And the difference in the padding. Peyton looked like he was like a military horse. Like with all, I mean, it was like the amount of pads on him, and Rex Grossman was wearing almost nothing.
Yeah.
And it was like, you're thinking, you're like, these guys are playing in the same game. And it's completely different. You look at quarterbacks today and how much, you know, how so many of them are wearing nothing, and then go back to, you know, the day and age where they were wearing, you know, everything. And you kind of do wonder about that, and whether people are, you know, giving up their bodies and saying, hey, you know, it's 100% CTE anyway, so I might as well just forget about and I'm making as much money as possible. Maybe it's just more important for me to be effective and for me to be able to get my arm out than be protected.
Darren, you mentioned something about Eddie George and his business ventures. It sparked a question that I would have for you specifically, because you used to write about the business of sports. You still tweet a lot about the business of sports. You're currently with the Action Network, and that's why you're with us right now. Action Network is great, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But I would say, in the athletes that you've run across that have gone into business, who's the most impressive? Because it was actually an NFLPA thing came by the other day, and it had Justin Tuck, who is now a vice president at Goldman Sachs, which kind of took me by surprise. What's that?
Yeah, Tuck's amazing.
Yeah.
He's actually invested in something that I'm invested in, so we've talked, and he's actually really – really impressive. He's investing in real things and is managing big time money, and is not just like some guy at Goldman Sachs who like shakes the hand and, you know, like, hey, we got a big fish coming in. Can you just say Justin Tuck to close the deal? That's not what he's doing. He's legit. Very impressed with him. Vinny Johnson of, you know, from the Detroit Pistons days, you know, basically started a billion-dollar auto parts company. So he's impressive. You know, obviously Kobe, I've had a chance to work with him on the business side. He's incredibly impressive. You know, I think J.J. Watt's actually going to be someone in business who's going to be amazing. A lot of these athletes have more and more interest in business, because some of them are just finding that, you know, when they leave the athletic world, they are just as competitive, and they can find their competitive edge and their love to compete in business. And that's why so many more of these athletes are doing it. You know, they love getting into companies, and I think it's obviously just much more sophisticated. 10 years ago, I have a guy who does this now. You know, a lot of guys during their career, like Durant's in 20 businesses right now. Yeah. So it's fascinating.
Yeah. Darren Revelle, Action Network, joining us on Sports Radio 610. Darren, this story about Daniel Snyder, the owner of the Redskins, leveraging states against each other, using gambling as sort of the platform to do so, trying to get gambling in the stadium if they were to build a stadium in Maryland. What are your thoughts on this story, and how many years away are we from being able to actually place wagers inside an NFL stadium?
Well, it's actually perfect for Daniel Snyder, because if you look at what's around him in you know, Maryland and Virginia, what's going on in D.C., which is that it's technically legal, but it's not operational. You know, he's in a place where when you're surrounded by of all the states that are legal, obviously the East Coast is really where it's been burgeoning. Nevada's number one, New Jersey's number two, Pennsylvania's number three. So honestly, you know, it's almost, I hate to say Daniel Snyder's making a good business move. It pains me, but he is. I mean, it's exactly the right place to be geographically to do this. Now, the NFL stadium type of thing, you know, we're going to have later this year, we'll have, you'll be able to bet inside Capital One Arena, you know, in DC, which is, you know, obviously right in his, where he is, with the Wizards and the Capitals. The key, though, is everyone thinks about, and I've talked about this with you guys before, everyone thinks about the kiosks, like, oh, there's going to be a kiosk that prints out the ticket, and the kiosks really aren't that profitable. What they try to do, and you've seen this with the New Jersey Devils and the Prudential Center, these casinos, these sports books do sponsorships, and they get you to try to get on, you know, just download our app, because they don't want one-offs of, hey, you go to the arena, you print out your ticket, you win or lose, and then, you know, they don't know where you are, who you are, or whatever. They want to know who you are. They want to get you hooked on their app, and they want you to place bets when you're on your couch. So if they can use the arena or the stadium to as the carrot to try to kind of try to draw you in, that's what they're going to do. But it's not really going to be our vision, my vision, everyone's vision 5-10 years ago is, when is the kiosk going to come to the stadium? And it's just not going to be like that.
Yeah, it's going to be on the phone. Darren Revelle, Action Network. So, Darren, before we let you go, are you taking this bye week to figure out what the fade Revelle for the Super Bowl is going to be, or have you come up with it yet?
It's going to be something with Patrick Mahomes and touchdowns. That's all I know.
Okay.
You know, by the way, I mean, so I had Lamar, people have really enjoyed the last couple of weeks. We've had a record number of people bet against me because they think I've been crazy. Lamar Jackson, no rushing touchdown. He didn't. I won that one. Thank God.
Oh, yeah.
I had to go to a wedding. And if I had to have gone to the wedding a couple of days after being a human bird feeder, slathering peanut butter on my body and having pigeons in Central Park eat off me. I don't know. I might have had to get a rabies shot. So that, you know, that obviously was, you know, I got by that. And then Derrick Henry not scoring any touchdown of any kind, you know, 5 minutes in, it happened. And people are like, oh, you're so dumb. And then he has like 7 yards in the second half. And it just was luck. I mean, it was just luck that they were down there on that, you know, where they were, and he scored at that time. It wasn't the stupidest bet. It's not like Derrick Henry had 7 touchdowns, but it was. I knew it was a coin toss. So I you know, I think the over/under on Patrick Mahomes' total touchdowns is going to be 2.5, and I'm going to take the under.
Okay.
Which people are going to think I'm crazy, but I actually think the under is a good bet there.
Well, he hadn't thrown any touchdown passes in a playoff game until this year. He threw zero in their two games last year.
I am committing now to not betting on either side. I just, you know, the Super Bowl is, because the oddsmakers have all the data from the entire year, I just don't like betting on the 49ers or the Chiefs here. I'll load up on props.
Yeah.
But I'm not confident in putting Super Bowl size money on either of them, to be honest with you.
That's Darren Revelle from the Action Network. Darren, we'll look forward to circling back with you next week on all the getting ready for the Super Bowl. If you're looking for an edge, download the free Action Network
app.
Are
you guys going down or no?
We are not this year for the so we will not be down there, but we'll catch up with you over the phone, hopefully from there.
Yep.
Sounds good. All right, Darren, we appreciate
it. Take care.
All right, there it is, Darren Revelle, Action Network. Download the free Action Network app, get live odds and expert analysis for every game.
It's now, one thing I've learned through the years of going to the Super Bowl or not going to the Super Bowl is the rule is, if you're not going to the Super Bowl, you act on air like, well, it's stupid to go to the Super Bowl anyway. I'm not going to do that. There's good and bad about being here. I will honestly say, I usually enjoy our trip to the Super Bowl. It's exhausting by the end of it, to the point where I have a hard time paying attention to the actual Super Bowl.
Yeah.
The worst Super Bowl was the Super Bowl that was in Houston. I felt like I was gypped out of screwed out of a vacation.
A trip.
Yeah, yeah. I felt like
you
I was.
You were probably pulled in a bunch of different directions that week, too.
Yeah. Well, but, okay, you know what? I take that back.
Because it's your city. You got a bunch of your former teammates.
I take it back. That was a good money making. I made some good money during
that.
There were a whole lot of opportunities available.
Look at you.
Dude,
Seth Payne's the guy with the Virginia ham under his arm complaining he doesn't have any bread.
I forgot about. Do you realize I hosted a pep rally for the Patriots? And I could not have been more unwelcome amongst that group of people. It was over at the convention center right before the game. And
how gross did you feel?
2,000 people in there, and all I kept doing, my strategy was, wow, at the time, we have all these former Patriots that are on staff for the Texans, Vrabel, Wes Welker. I became like a really annoying name dropper, you know, of guys that I didn't even actually know. You know, like I've never even actually met Welker. It's like, hey, how about Wes Welker?
My guy.
Somebody asked for
Did you call them our Patriots when you were at the pep rally?
No, I
know of some hosts that like to call teams our team.
Somebody did think that I was Rob Gronkowski because Gronkowski was injured that year, remember?
You don't look like Gronk, but were you acting like Gronk in the moment?
Maybe that's
what
it was.
That must be Gronk.
Look
at the guy.
Like,
he's smashing beer cans on his head.
It was weird because this guy came up to me and he was like, hey, it's you, isn't it? And I'm like, I don't know. Who do you think I am?
Sure is.
Yeah. And I'm like, he's like, can I get your autograph? And I was like, you sure can, but whose autograph do you think you're getting? And he goes, you're Gronk, right? I'm like, no, you're an idiot. You're like, how the hell did you afford tickets to this game?
No,
I don't look like him. He's about 3 inches taller than me.
So how many people were
a little bit more shredded.
How many people were at this pep rally that you hosted?
It was pretty big. I would say a couple thousand, maybe.
Really?
I don't know. Maybe. Yeah, it was
huge. Did you have to get people fired up and stuff?
I tried.
How disgusting did you feel with yourself that you were firing up Patriot fans to win their billionth Super Bowl?
Dude, it was a good paycheck. I don't
That's
care.
What was sort of my
I
question.
Didn't feel bad
I don't want to go
all.
Pocket watching, and I'm not going to ask you on the air how much
they paid
you.
I did it with integrity. I did it with I didn't talk about how, you know what, and that's part of it. I think they're probably used to these pep rallies where they were expecting some guy to come in and be like, how's it feel to be a fan of the greatest team that ever was? I didn't do any of that.
Good.
So basically what I'm telling you, Sean, is I don't think I did a very good job.
According to them, I cashed that check. Hell yeah, you did. In the loop guys are not in here doing a toss. Landry just texted me saying Lopez has the ultimate nobody is talking about involving Justin Reed and mic'd up in the loop fake BOB audio.
Okay.
That must be what Landry was doing in there.
It's the ultimate what nobody is talking about. Yeah, I heard him screaming.
Yeah.
I thought there was an actual confrontation going down and it was just him screaming into the mic recording something.
Can't wait to find out what it actually is. That'll be in the loop. Those guys are up next. John Lopez and Landry Locker, they've got you till 2. Seth, I will see you tomorrow at 6 a.m.
Hasta mañana.
All right, there it is. Seth Payne, Sean Pendergast, we are done. We are out of time. We will see you tomorrow at 6 a.m. Have a great day, everybody.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.